Are you struggling with kids fighting, yelling, and more despite listening to the podcast and reading all the books? Parenting can be so overwhelming and exhausting. You know, I see you and I have something that will help. Mindful Parenting SOS. I'm offering free live mindful parenting sessions starting Monday, May 6th. Basically, live mindful parenting lessons that you normally have to pay for. So if you struggle with getting your kids to listen, tantrums, misbehavior, and feeling the guilt of yelling at your kid, then you should definitely get your spot in Mindful Parenting SOS. I'll be there to answer your questions in person, and if you can't make it, we will have replays available. Don't wait to get your spot now. It's free. Go to mindfulmamamentor.com/SOS to register. That's mindfulmamamentor.com/SOS. I can't wait to see you there.
It's an excellent opportunity to break away from the curriculum-based model of school and give kids a chance to just sort of free play, in a sense, academically.
You're listening to the Mindful Mama podcast, episode number 263. Today, we're talking about how to handle remote learning with Stephen Green. Welcome to the Mindful Mama podcast. Here, it's about becoming a less irritable, more joyful parent. At Mindful Mama, we know that you cannot give what you do not have, and when you have calm and peace within, then you can give it to your children. I'm your host, Hunter Clark Fields. I help smart, thoughtful parents stay calm so they can have strong, connected relationships with their children. I've been practicing mindfulness for over 20 years. I'm the creator of Mindful Parenting, and I'm the author of the best-selling book, Raising Good Humans, a mindful guide to breaking the cycle of reactive parenting and raising kind, confident kids. Welcome back to the Mindful Mama podcast, my friend. I'm so happy you're here. As I record this, I'm looking out my window at beautiful snow falling, and that's mostly making me happy. So wherever you are, whether you have snow or you don't have snow, I hope you're doing well. If you're new here, of course, a special welcome to you. This is going to be a great conversation. And it's so crazy because, you know, I thought that by February 2021, we would not have to talk about more about remote learning. But you know, so many of us are still struggling. You know, it's not easy. A lot of us are having a hard time with it. A lot of kids are going back, but a lot of kids aren't. So I wanted to bring in Stephen Green. He's an author and educator, founder of Making the Grade, a tutoring education company. And we're going to talk about how to make it better. How to make it better. We can get there. So I want you to listen for some important things, especially for little kids. This can be an excellent opportunity to break away from the curriculum-based model and give kids a chance to free play, in a sense, academically. We're going to talk about how, on the opposite end, high schoolers are actually at the most risk for falling behind and having a more long-term impact. So listen for the different ages that we talk about and how we as parents should be advocating for our child's success. So we talk quite a bit about that. And I think you'll find a lot here to dive into, to learn. Before we dive in, I want to give a shout out to Enel Brack. Sorry if I mispronounce it, for the 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Thank you so very much. And she said, or he said, that Hunter is an authentic soul who acknowledges her mistakes and growth as a mother, who makes her listeners feel comfortable enough to see our own truths and growths. She has incredible guests who add to the mindfulness revolution. I love it. Yes, the revolution. Thank you so much. That makes such a big impact to add those reviews there. So thank you, thank you, thank you. And now join me at the table as I talk to Stephen Green. All right, Steve, thank you so much for coming on the Mindful Mama podcast.
Oh, Hunter, thank you for having me. Looking forward to our conversation. And happy Tuesday to everyone. So listening, I don't know, but yeah.
Well, it's interesting. The podcast does come out on Tuesdays. It probably is a Tuesday for a lot of people, but hello to future people. Hello. So I'm excited to talk to you specifically right now because of what's going on in the world of the crazy pandemic and stuff. So I'll just give you, obviously people have kids who are all remote learning, kids who are going to school sometimes, some kids who are going into school all the time. In my own house, I have a fifth grader. She's going in 4 mornings a week, and my eighth grader has chosen for the semester to be completely remote. And I know a lot of people who are doing completely remote for safety reasons, but it sucks. Like, people are unhappy. It was when
I like your candor.
When my 10-year-old was completely remote for between like Thanksgiving and Christmas, it's hard. Like, she's missing a whole bunch of stuff. Like, she just is like, and I feel like it's like kind of killing that spark, you know. Like I told you, mm-hmm. I'm really interested in Montessori because of like, I want to keep that spark and love of learning alive. And I feel like remote learning is like killing the spark. So anyway, this is to introduce the whole topic of remote learning and like, how can we do this better? And I know that's a hard question to answer because there's so many different styles and things happening all around the country, but I'll let you start us off here, Steve.
Well, let me start out by saying this. I think like anything in life, you're going to get a lot of perspectives on the same thing, right? Mm-hmm. So what you expressed, I don't want to put words in your mouth, I think is kind of a parent's perspective, right? Mm-hmm. Then you got a teacher's perspective. You've got sort of a school board perspective. You got a government level perspective, and it gets complicated. But I always look at it this way: education first and foremost should always be about the children, the students. Because I was an educator, I was a teacher, I was a college instructor. The priority should be: are the children learning? A, and B, are they being taught in a way that works for them? There's many different styles of learning, many different styles of teaching, and so on and so on. So I think to some degree, you could look at this from various viewpoints, but my observation is this. I think that there has to be an acceptance that it's just not the same sitting at home in front of a computer as it is going into a school or any learning situation and expecting to get the same result. Exactly. Right. So there's got to be compromises. And I could tell you lots of individual stories, and I've counseled schools and I've counseled teachers on this, but that's the message I try to get out there is number one, the students have to understand what they're up against, which is a teacher that's a little bit compromised in the delivery ability, because most teachers didn't become teachers to become virtual teachers. They like being in a room with kids and they like people and things like that. And a lot of teachers, frankly, aren't all that comfortable with technology. Mm-hmm. I mean, they can work computers in the classroom, and I think that's improving collectively. But I don't think most teachers signed up to be basically sort of on camera personalities, so to speak, trying to communicate to something. And then you got the subject considerations, right? Not everybody loves math. What about you growing up? I was a math teacher. Sometimes it's very difficult to keep kids engaged in a math class because if they don't like it, they tend to shut down, they get bored, so on and so on. So this is just the normal academic challenges, right? Keeping kids engaged, having well-designed, objective-based instruction that paces kids through things in a way that keeps them going, combination of activities and instruction, so on and so on. And trying to do that remotely with everybody in different places is not easy. But I think as we do it longer and longer, I think people get used to it. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean it gets better. And I could liken it to like a relationship, right? I know a lot of people that are married and are unhappy, but they get so used to being unhappy that they consider it normal. So they're not really trying to change it. But I don't know if it's an apt example here. But I think what happens is you start to settle mm-hmm. for something that is suboptimal, right? Mm-hmm. I think as a parent, we send our kids to school and say, look, we hope you have a great day. Hope you have fun with your friends. Hope you learn a lot. Come home excited. You know, we want them all to be engaged and active learners. And I think that's where it's tough. I mean, it's at a point now where a lot of schools aren't even talking about grades. Like, they've just thrown grades out the window. It's like, well, it's hard to assess kids. It's hard to give tests kids aren't cheating on or whatever, or being dishonest about. So that's kind of where it is. I mean, it's a little bit all over the map. And I'll add one last thing to it, which is this all, at least where we live, really kind of came together. It was right around St. Patrick's Day. It was about March 15th. All of a sudden, it went from mostly normal to like shut down, bang. And the initial instructions were, we're going to shut down for a couple of weeks. This will clear out. We'll be back by April 15th. It happened to be the spring break for a lot of schools. It was right around then. Mm-hmm. So we went in through that. And then it was like, oh, we're going to go to the end of April. Oh, we're going to go to the end of May, June. I don't think anybody envisioned it going potentially through this entire school year and maybe beyond.
Yeah.
So that is sort of a shock in of itself. There's so many layers here, I guess is what I'm trying to say, that it's hard to really hone in only on one.
Yeah.
I tend to look at it from the perspective of the students. You know, are they getting the value that they need?
So yes, I think what you said, like, let's accept that it's not the same. We're not going to get the same outcomes. You know, we have to kind of get to this level of like, okay, like this kind of in some ways sort of in stepping back to where we were in March, where we were like, oh, this is going to be totally different. And we're accepting that our kids are not having this same experience right now. We're like, okay, fine. But then I guess the problem is, you know, so we understand there has to be some compromises, but I guess the problem is like, you know, it's like when we go in, as we go through so much time, like, I mean, my kids, at least, like, they're a little older. They can follow the directions from their teacher at school. They don't need me there with them. Like, maybe we can take this a little bit like age by age and think about like, what are some ways we can make it better? Like, yes, accepting that it stinks, it's not as good, and make it better kind of age by age. Cause sometimes I think about like, if you have a kindergartner, sometimes that in my mind, my idea is like, who cares? You know, like, let them read, let them play, right? Like, kindergarten should be very play-based, experiential-based anyway. It's not like super academic anyway. Mm-hmm. So then that's great. So maybe if your kid's 5 and under, you can, you know, it can just be kind of like life learning. But then what about, I think that people start to feel worried and feel anxious when it's like, I had a kindergartner last year, and then have a child going into first grade. And this is like their first experience with school is like this age. So Do you have any suggestions or advice for people whose kids are like 6 and 7, like really young learners who are maybe just a little beyond that, just play and life based kind of learning and maybe starting to get into academic learning? How can we as parents support like parents 6 and 7 year olds? And then maybe we can kind of go up in the ages and think about that.
My opinion is that I think this is a good opportunity to take advantage of what interests the children. I agree with you about kindergarten, and I would even maybe go up to second or third grade. It's a lot of this is socialization. I mean, in a normal setting, a lot is learning to get along with other kids. A lot of this is learning to be structured in a setting. You know, where, you know, 6 hours is not natural for a kid to sit still.
Yeah.
And so I think from an intellectual stimulation standpoint, I think you could take half the day, take 2-3 hours out of a 4-6 hour school day, and say, look, let's do something project based. What interests you? Now, of course, I don't know how much a 6-year-old is going to volunteer. You know, I'm not going to say, well, I want to do a report on Mozart versus Beethoven. I mean, but I think it's a good chance to break away from traditional curriculum. Mm-hmm. Instead of pigeonholing it and saying, well, you got to spend 45 minutes on math and 75 minutes on ILA or, you know, whatever, and this much on language and
what's
history.
ILA?
Language arts.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a whatever teacher term.
Teacher term. I've heard ELA, English Language Arts, but not ILA.
ILA. I forget the I stands for anyway. Well, whatever. Language arts. I know it's language arts. But okay, I mean, my point is, I think at that age, it's an excellent opportunity to break away from the curriculum-based model of school, mm-hmm. and give kids chance to just sort of free play in a sense academically. Now, here's the one beauty I don't see people taking advantage of. And I'll jump ahead a little bit of the conversation and say, we could do this at any grade level. Mm-hmm. One of the beauties of the whole internet cloud thing, assuming people have access to it and have strong enough signal, is it's very, very easy to collaborate. You know, you can take a room or a whatever they're in, teams, break kids up, have them do something as a group, or people could do things individually. Like, it's very easy to share a file and people work collectively on a file. I was overseeing a pod. I don't know if pods were big where you were, but they were pretty big here. And we did a project where there were six kids and they each got 2 pages of a PowerPoint, a shareable PowerPoint. They had to do a project about energy. So each kid kind of did their own thing, and then but collectively became this larger project. And I think you could do that at any grade level, but I think specifically for younger kids, I think you need to shorten the instructional time online. Okay. I don't think it's practical to expect a kid to sit there for an hour, hour and a half straight and remain engaged. It's just not normal. I think you shorten it. You do like 15 minutes on, 15 off, or something like that. And in the 15 on screen, they would learn something. Then you give them something active to go do. Mm-hmm. So you say, all right, we're going to learn how to write the letter A and B. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's a little, that's about first grade. They start learning handwriting and stuff, right? Mm-hmm. So you say, all right, now go take a little walk, go get a snack, whatever. And then come back. I want you to practice, do 10 A's and 10 B's. Let them do it on their own. Mm-hmm. And it models a little bit what would normally go on in a classroom. A teacher is not instructing and lecturing continually for 6 straight hours. But it gets the kids used to that a little bit more. Mm-hmm. And it gets them to have some pride in their work. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that's been missing is because one of the things that enables you to get buy-in from a student academically is when they take pride in what they're doing, or they have a strong interest in what they're doing, and they want to do more of it, or they want to start to expand on it on their own a little bit.
Parenting can be loud, stressful, and rough some days. And we want to be able to go to bed and take care of ourselves in a really beautiful way. And that's why I love that Cozy Earth is a sponsor of the podcast. Cozy Earth offers bedding products that will transform your sleep. The bedding is temperature regulating, which is like a huge sleep benefit, has superior softness, incredible fabric, and incredibly high quality. All the products come with a 10-year warranty. Truly, incorporating Cozy Earth products into your self-care routine can enhance your sleep quality and your overall wellness. You deserve to treat yourself to the ultimate in comfort and indulgence after all the day's craziness of parenting with Cozy Earth bedding and sleepwear. And it's a way to prioritize your self-care and sleep health. You deserve it. And here's an exclusive Mother's Day offer just for our listeners. Use the code MINDFUL35 for 35% off. That's awesome. At CozyEarth.com. That's coupon code MINDFUL35. For 35% off at CozyEarth.com. It is beautiful here in Delaware. All the trees are blooming and all the flowers are blooming. It is gorgeous, but that means that people in my family and myself are suffering from some allergy symptoms. So I am thrilled to let you know about Astepro. You may not know about it. It's brand new. It's a first of its kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, but I swear, like, it started working so quickly. I used it right before I went for a run, and it worked so quickly. Astepro delivers full prescription strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief. So it could be like from cats as well, from nasal congestion, runny nose, itchy nose, and sneezing. I love that it goes right in my nose, so it's not like going in all the different parts of my body. It is steroid-free. It is working so, so fast. Get fast-acting nasal allergy relief with Astepro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can Astepro and go today. That's A-S-T-E-P-R-O allergy.com. Astepro and go. Use as directed for relief from nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itching due to allergies.
Yeah, you want to take advantage of that natural interest. So this all requires like us as the parents, or whether if they have some adult or a babysitter or whatever.
Or an older sibling.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you got to have that when you have younger kids.
I think you'd have to anyway, because you can't leave a six-year-old at home alone.
Yeah, you can't.
I mean, just as a parent, you can't do that. Mm-hmm. So, but I think from an instructional standpoint, you're only going to get so much out of it at that level. I mean, there's only so much, the complexity of what you can teach is limited to some degree. But I think the key is to get the kids to have an interest in what they're doing, mm-hmm. instead of just sort of robotically dealing with it, which happens at the older grades. Because at the older grades, it's like, well, we're learning this. We're learning about American history and the Civil War, whether you like it or not, and too bad. Or, you know, whatever the curriculum is at that point in time. Mm-hmm. Let me add one last thing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, please.
Some of this, to a degree, and you hear a lot about this, and I don't think this is really what this conversation is about, but some of this, to a degree, is limited by technology. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, we don't need to get into the fact that, you know, inner city schools don't have as many computers as suburban, whatever. But not every kid is as good at technology as others. So what I've been advocating in the schools that I'm working in is take a little bit of time to just teach the kids the tech. Mm-hmm. There's an assumption that just because a kid is a kid and maybe has a phone and it is way more precocious technologically than I might have been at that age for sure, because it didn't exist, or my own kids would have been because it barely existed. Don't assume every kid is technologically savvy, right?
That's so true. My daughter didn't know that there were special assignments for 3 months.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
She didn't even know they existed. She didn't know how to log on to them, and no one was following up to see if she was
right. So I think this is an opportunity to get out of the box a little bit and teach some things. Younger grade level, middle, whatever, that you wouldn't normally address because they're not needed in the classroom. Mm-hmm. Like in a class, you know, you go into a classroom, there's always that, like, class rules, right? You got a big poster, raise your hand, don't talk when other people are talking, put your pencils away, you know. Well, now you need virtual learning rules. I don't like using the word rules because it sort of implies a strictness, but you need guidelines. You need standards that everybody understands. And I don't think that's ever really been formalized, at least in any teaching situation I've seen. Maybe some teachers do it individually. I don't want to say none do, but I think it gives an opportunity to make sure everybody's on the same page with that skill set.
All right. This is great. So what I hear you say is, like, take advantage of some of the interests of the child, shorten that instructional time. Too. And I guess my question about, and then also, like, let's take advantage of, we are on this technology. Like, let's make sure everyone really, really knows it and is really clear. You know, that's essential.
Let me add one thing here, Hunter, mm-hmm. is, listen, I think it's naive for anybody to think that even when we go back to quote unquote normal, that virtual learning is going to go away completely.
Yeah, that's true.
Right. And the use of the computers is just going to accelerate. The mesh of technology and live learning is just going to get stronger because it's convenient. I mean, you know what this is going to, there's a couple of problems it's going to solve. One is, what if a kid's sick from school? Mm-hmm. I mean, not sick like COVID. Like, let's say 2 years from now, a kid has, I don't know, runny nose, fever. Mm-hmm. You don't want to send them to school. They're out 2 days. Well, historically, what was their choice? They sit home, they do nothing. They get the homework from their friends. They're 2 days behind when they come back. If they're unlucky, they got a quiz or a test or a paper due, then now they got to cram for or make some kind of arrangement to catch up, right? Hmm. Well, now, guess what? We have a very easy solution. Live stream the class or semi-live stream the class, even if it's just a camera projecting it that the kid can watch, send the homework home virtually or have it in a shared file, because now that everybody has availability to that, it definitely mitigates, possibly even eliminates, this whole idea of the big issue you have with sick days.
Yeah.
No, especially when you have an extended, you know, I've had kids that work with concussions, are out of school 2-3 weeks or, you know, worse. And they miss like half years of school. There are some positives that can be harnessed here if everybody's on the same page developing things sort of in parallel with each other.
And in the interests of the child. I mean, I definitely agree with you. Like, there's got to be benefits to it. But for the parents who, what would you say? So say the listener has a child who's like seven years old, and, you know, the school is not quite so savvy about what's really working for the kids and wants mm-hmm. the kids to sit there for like a 2 hour thing. But, you know, this parent may be able to see, like, my 7-year-old needs to, like, run around the block, like, every 15 minutes because they're you know, a human being in a body, yeah, not just sure. Especially, face on yeah, a screen. So
no question.
Do you have any ideas for how people can communicate the needs of those kids or advocate for their kids? These like really real needs that we can see for the kids in these situations?
This goes back a little bit to what I opened with was mm-hmm. the different perspectives, right? Mm-hmm. You got the students who got one perspective. You got the parents of another. You got the teachers with another. One of the challenges of being a teacher is historically called classroom management, right? Mm-hmm. Which is not such a fancy term and is exactly what it sounds like. Managing your class, not letting kids talk, keeping everybody focused, dealing with any obstreperous behavior that comes up. Well, it's a whole nother animal online, right? You know what the biggest issue online is? Kids turning their camera off. Or kids clearly doing other things, right? Like,
yeah.
Like I'm supposed to be doing math with you and I'm like, oh, you know, I'm like hiding my phone so you can't see it. The teachers aren't dumb. They know what the kids are doing. The kids are chatting with each other. They're talking to other people. They're eating. So the whole world of classroom management has changed in this micro situation. I think like anything else, to answer your question, it's a matter of communication, right? Mm-hmm. I don't think there's anything wrong at this point because a six-year-old, eight-year-old is not going to advocate for themselves this way. But a parent just emailing a teacher and saying, listen, Mrs. Johnson, my kid just is not adapting well to this. I really need them to take a break about every 20 minutes, do something a little bit physical, get some energy burnt. It's fine with me. I am home. I'm in a virtual desk as well. And believe me, when they're on the screen, they're going to be engaged. One of the things I always tell parents, this is a little sidebar from really what we're talking about, is I've worked with a lot of families who've had kids with issues in school, not necessarily like emotional or anything, just they don't get along with teachers all the time. They argue about a grade or maybe there's a misunderstanding. And I always tell parents and students the same thing, which is if you're going to go in and have any sort of confrontation or argument or discussion, dialogue, call it what you may, you'll get 100 times further if you offer a solution. Mm. If you just go in and say, you're an idiot, you're the worst teacher I ever had, my kid hates you, I'm surprised you have a job, some other nasty things I've been in rooms with parents accusing teachers about, you're not going to get very far. Everybody gets defensive. It gets ugly. It's not productive. But if you go in and say, listen, I know little Hunter here got a 52 on her math test, but she really tried. And I really think she understood it. I think she just froze up on the test. Can we arrange to have her make up the test? And, you know, I get it. You want to be fair with grades. Maybe she just gets 80% credit on the second one. If you're reasonable, most teachers are going to say, you know what, that's fair. We just have to do it by Friday or, you know, whatever, make mm-hmm. a deadline. And everybody agrees. Mm-hmm. And I think it's the exact same mindset with this. We're in an unusual situation. Everybody's got all kinds of stuff going on. I mean, I had a kid I was working with and they had a dog and the dog barked. I never saw a dog do this. The dog barked nonstop for 60 straight minutes. Loud. It wasn't even like, it was one of these annoying, like high-pitched, like chirpy dog bark. It was like a terrier or something, I'm going to guess. I didn't even saw the dog. But I'm saying that like, that's not the kid's fault. Who's supposed to be monitoring the dog while the kid's supposed to be learning? I don't know. Is it a babysitter? Is it another parent? I don't know whose job it was. And I must have said four times to the kid, boy, your dog's really loud, like sort of a hint, like, you know, can you go quiet the dog down or shut the door or something? So these, you know, multiply that by 15, 20, 25, everybody, many kids are in a class, and you've got all these potential things going on. I think another way to answer your question is, I'm a big fan of creativity, right? Of allowing children, I don't care if they're 6, 15, 30, 30 is not really a kid, but to be able to express their creativity. And my observation being a teacher and still being in education full-time is that creativity sometimes takes a backseat, except maybe in a creative writing class or maybe an English class. But in math, there's not a lot of creativity, not in history, not in science. And I think anytime you can bring anything into a learning situation that enables a child to be expressive. So instead of just writing a paper about something, maybe they build a model. Maybe they get clay and they build something. Or if they're good at music, they make a song. Or if they're artistic, they can draw a picture or something. And little younger kids love this. It isn't until we get older that it's sort of bad to draw. I mean, you know, like you're told, well, what are you doing? You're wasting time. You know, pay attention, take notes. So I think there's ways that this could happen as well. So if you're learning something, you know, maybe you let the kid do something artistic or creative or mm-hmm. musical or whatever. So I think there are different outlets. Some are physical, some are more imaginatory or imaginative, but I think those are things that can be done as well.
I want to tell you about a great podcast that you should check out, especially if you ever deal with any school system, which you probably do. It's called Understood Explains. This season of the show is hosted by teacher and special education expert Juliana Ortubé, and it's all about how to navigate individual education plans, also known as IEPs. And this season of Understood Explains covers topics like how to tell if your child needs an IEP and busts common myths about special education. So I checked out the episode on the difference between IEPs and 504 plans because my daughter Maggie uses a 504 plan, and it was really, really helpful. It went over all the differences, which one's better, how to get them, different myths and what your rights are, all kinds of different things that you should understand if your child may need extra help in education through an IEP or a 504 plan. The tone is super helpful, friendly, and smart. I highly recommend you check it out. To listen to Understood Explains, just search for Understood Explains in your podcast app. That's it. Understood Explains. So my husband's had hair thinning issues for years, for a long time. It's not something he'd love to have, and he's done some things for it. But recently, he started using Nutrafol, and oh my gosh, we have actually seen quite a difference. Did you know that for women, hair thinning happens in approximately 1 in 2 women? And if you're among them, I want you to know that you're definitely not alone. It's normal, but it's not openly talked about, and going through it can feel lonely and frustrating. But you can join over 1 million people who are doing something about it with Nutrafol. Nutrafol is the number one dermatologist recommended hair growth supplement, with over 1 million people seeing thicker, stronger, faster growing hair with less shedding, like my honey. Physician formulated with drug-free ingredients, Nutrafol supplements support healthy hair growth from within by targeting root causes of thinning, including stress, hormones, environment, nutrition, lifestyle, and metabolism as they evolve throughout a woman's life. And while many supplements rely solely on ingredient studies, Nutrafol clinically tests final formulations to ensure their efficacy. In a clinical study, 86% of women reported improved hair growth after taking Nutrafol's women's hair growth supplement for 6 months. With Nutrafol, building a hair growth routine is simple. Purchase online, no prescription required, free shipping, and automated deliveries to ensure you'll never miss a day. See results in 3 to 6 months. Take the first step to visibly thicker, healthier hair. For a limited time, Nutrafol is offering our listeners $10 off your first month's subscription and free shipping when you go to Nutrafol.com and enter the promo code MINDFULPARENTING. Find out why over 4,500 healthcare professionals and hairstylists recommend Nutrafol for healthier hair. Nutrafol.com, spelled Nutrafol.com, promo code MINDFULPARENTING. That's Nutrafol.com, promo code MINDFULPARENTING.
I mean, I like that, you know, the way you talk about talking to a teacher is like kind of just saying, acknowledging like, these are the needs my child has, but also like acknowledging that you as a teacher might have these needs, right? For everyone to be kind of focused and attentive. And here's a way we can meet everybody's needs, like in the same situation, just trying to be productive that way and saying like, let's figure out a solution to meet everybody's needs. And so dear listener, if you're hearing what Stephen's saying and you're like, I want that, well, ask for it, you know, talk to your teacher. Like, they're reasonable people. They're trying to figure this stuff out too. So they may be trying to fit like a situation that worked better in person into an online situation and not quite be as flex, you know, they may not realize yet what the kids are needing on the other side. So yeah, be your kid's advocate and talk about those things. I love what you're saying about those like creative solutions. In my kids' classroom, they often have the choice of like a PowerPoint presentation, a story, or a drawing, or like a sculpture to do a project on something. And like, they've been making all these PowerPoint presentations. And actually my older daughter, when she was in seventh grade, she got to make a podcast to do a project on, and she did a podcast. which I thought was great. I mean, she wouldn't take any advice from me on that one, how to do a podcast.
Why should she? She's your child. Well, I'll tell you something interesting, I believe anyway, is clearly education as it sits in our present time is much different than it was even 10 years ago. The deliverability, the internet has changed so many things. Just the way kids research, right? Who goes to a library? Who even opens a book? I mean, which is kind of sad, but for thousands of years, education was more or less the same. And you know, I actually in graduate school had a class that traced the whole etiology of education. Our educational system in the United States, not surprisingly, traces back to England, right? Because we were an English colony, right? Well, where did the English education system come from? Europe. Where'd that come from? Rome. Where'd that come from? Greece. You're talking 5,000 years here. It hasn't really changed that much, which is basically the model that the teacher has the information, the Socratic method, and is projecting that information to the students, right? Mm-hmm. So the idea of like child-centered education or student-driven education or the kids kind of making up their own curriculum is a relatively new idea. But it's fueled now because there's so many other ways kids can get the information. It's the teacher is no longer the only expert in the subject matter because you've got online videos, you've got websites, you've got so many other places that this information can be culled from. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, you still need some kind of authority, I guess, in the situation, but it's really a huge paradigm shift in just education, period.
Oh yeah.
I think the older the grade level, the more pronounced this gets, mm-hmm. because you start to get such a split of kids' abilities, right? I mean, roughly speaking, first, second, third graders are fairly close in ability level. You're always going to get some precocious ones and some that are a little bit behind the curve, but it gets much, much broader as kids get older. You know, by 10th, 11th grade, there's a huge disparity, sometimes grade level, multiple grade level differences in kids' abilities.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's imagine that we are getting into the older kids. Like you have, you know, like kid, my child's age.
Like you have a seventh grade, right?
Seventh grade.
So it's 13 or 12.
Or no, seventh grade, like middle school, mm-hmm. or even fifth, sixth, and seventh grade. They know how to learn. They've done school for a while, but they're home, they're remote learning, and they're just, I don't know, I guess, how can we support the kids to engage with it, you know, and to keep that interest and to, or, you know, I mean, I guess that the thing that I'm worried about most is like, I don't care so much about her learning all the vocabulary words for fifth grade or getting to a certain math level in fifth grade. What I'm really worried about most is like her hating school because of remote learning. So I don't know. I don't know what the answer is to that. I don't know what the question is.
At least in part, is you have to keep them challenged. You got to push the envelope a little bit. I mean, just because it's remote doesn't mean what would work in regular school doesn't work. Mm-hmm. It's just a different delivery, right? So I don't think there's any need to completely throw out the things that could be successful modes in school, in classroom setting, just because it's remote. I think it's a consideration more of adapting and sort of saying, well, we need to do more of this, less of this. Mm-hmm. So clearly I've observed this, didn't take me long to see this. The lecture model doesn't work, especially for an older kid, does not work well remotely. In a classroom setting, a teacher can probably get away with more or less lecturing for 35 or 40 minute class. And the kids, because they're basically good kids and they're not gonna act out, are basically just gonna sit there and deal with it. That doesn't work well in a remote situation. Many things to distract the kid.
Yes.
They're not interested that much anyway. At least in school, they can look at their friends. They can kind of like, you know, I don't know, whatever, pass notes, whatever they're going to do sort of innocently. So you got to acknowledge that some things are going to work well and some won't. On the other hand, it would be considered comparably poor teaching for a teacher to walk into a classroom and say, hey, for the next 3 days, we're just going to work on a project, or I'm going to sit at my desk and read the newspaper.
Yeah.
Parents will say, well, what's the teacher getting paid for doing that, right? Mm-hmm. So, but on a remote situation, that's a good idea. But you're never going to do both for 100% of a class period. So I think the answer, which is certainly not a black and white absolute answer here, is you got to do more of what works well in the remote setting. And sometimes that's trial and error. Mm-hmm. You got to do less of what doesn't work well. And then I think the third piece of that triangle a little bit is trying to give the kids give the kids some time individually to just pursue something that they personally like or they personally find interesting. Even if it has nothing to do with the curriculum, right? Even if it's just, hey, you know, we're going to take 10 minutes a day and you can just work on an individual project. And at the end of 2 weeks, everybody's going to do a little presentation to class about what they did. It's just some level of accountability. Mm-hmm. Or else the kids won't do anything, or they'll, you know, do it the day before. But I think that's part of it. And I think the other piece of this is, you know, what was one of the things that's hard to do, but in class is, okay, guys, it's math time. All right, you know, Danny, Alice, Bill, Charlie, Alyssa, and Frank, go up to the board and you guys do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. You know, and you got this, you know, this old school, right? You got kids that chalk and they're all writing on the board trying to do the math problems. Everybody else is like, rrr. Okay, did they get it right? Did your answer the same? That you can't really do that remotely, right? Mm-mm. But you can have kids, if you break out rooms, right? Like in Zoom or, you know, Teams, you can break out into groups. So you say, okay, here's an idea. Why don't we break everybody out into groups of four, for example? And you're just going to do, you got four math problems. Group one has 1, 2, 3, 4. This group has 5, 6, 7, 8. Each one of you take one problem and show everybody else how to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. So they're teaching each other, and that's the best way to learn anything, is to teach someone else how to do it. So there's, what you're describing really is like engagement, you know, like where the teacher is less like a lecturer, less a deliverer of information and more of a coach, you know, like here, we're all together learning this thing. What are the best ways that we can get people engaged in learning mm-hmm. this together? And so that's really what we need to. So maybe dear listener, the best bet is to just say, dear teacher, please listen to this episode of the podcast with Stephen Green.
Well, they obviously. Well, but I'm not saying this because I want to be clear about this. I'm not saying any teacher isn't trying to do the best they can.
Oh, no.
I just think that the reality is that there are things that work great in a normal setting that don't work well in remote, and vice versa. And I think there's just a need to acknowledge that, and better yet, take advantage of it. And some people, forget teachers, are stubborn. I've been doing it this way for 32 years. Why should I be changing now? Nobody's going to tell me how to do this anymore. I mean, you get that on both sides and every side. But I think that's really the secret. And the schools and the people, the teachers and the circumstances I've worked with, where I've been able to give them some of these ideas, the feedback's almost always very positive. Because frankly, it just works better. You know, it's accomplishing the goal, which is to learn something. It's also accomplishing a goal of keeping kids engaged, which is difficult. And knowing that they're being engaged and not just staring out the window and acting like they're engaged. And also it creates long-term. There's one thing we didn't talk about, which is in education, you have short-term objectives and you have long-term objectives, right? So it's like, okay, guys and girls, today we're going to learn how to multiply 3 times 4. Okay, short-term objective. Well, we got long-term objectives because later we want to try to multiply 32 by 45 or something. So you have foundational skills, usually a short-term objective, that's now going to be bundled into a longer-term objective. You don't usually use this vocabulary or jargon when you're actually teaching a student. You don't describe it this way, but this is pretty much how it works. And I think that's stuff that you want to build into these lessons as well. And you could do them in parallel. I mean, these are things, I mean, guessing you didn't go to school to become a teacher, but frankly, you know, I did. And a lot of the classes
actually, I have a master's in art education.
Oh, there you go. Right.
So there you go. I did. I forget though.
Well, but I mean, you know, like I sat through classes in college and in graduate school that had titles like, objective planning. Mm. It's like, what does that mean? So you spend 13, I don't know how many hours, but 40 hours learning how to basically set a goal that you want kids to learn. Like, it's not that complicated, But there's so many layers to it sometimes. There's so many different ways you can overlap them and intertwine them that can get a little complicated if you don't plan it out right. And that's the other piece is everything we're talking about requires some level of planning. By the teacher, by the students a little bit, somebody has to drive this. And you can't say, well, I'm going to worry about what we're doing Monday on Monday, and I'm worried about Tuesday. This needs to be like, I got a week long plan, and Monday fits into the rest of it. And I got a monthly plan. This is how week one fits into the 4 weeks, things like this. And again, I'm not suggesting people aren't doing this, but I think it's even more important when there's a little less certainty that the message is getting across, perhaps. I think the last thing I would say is if we flash forward to the older grades, mm-hmm. which is potentially the most complicated part of this discussion or mm-hmm. the most simple, I think there you've got the advanced students, most of them you can almost just let do what they want to do because they're motivated. They've got the skills. They really don't need a strong instructional presence. It's the kids who aren't strong students that are really getting lost. And I see this a lot in my private practice. So the kids are just, they're behind anyway. They can't keep up. They just get further and further disenfranchised from what's going on. They eventually say, whatever, I didn't like this anyway, or I don't care if I get a D, you know, that sort of thing. There's no chance for a teacher to physically walk around the room and say, hey, you know, you okay? Or, you know, stuff like that. So they've lost that kind of personal thing as well. That's the people I worry about at that age level.
And how can we as parents support those kids? Like if we think I have one of those kids who's getting lost in the system, who's struggling, mm-hmm. is not being seen, how can we support those kids?
Step one's always awareness, but the kid's probably not frequently going to volunteer it. Because you say how school, fine. I mean, like my kids are in their 20s now. So I'm through the whole window of every potential level of being ignored. You know, so you're not going to have an in-depth conversation. So I think this is an advantage if you're home to just observe, you know, just, I mean, it won't be nosy or, you know, I mean, privacy things, I guess, but you kind of just stand outside the kid's room and just listen to what's going on in school and see if the kid's actually doing anything. Because most of these things are insidious, right? It's not like one day a kid becomes a disinterested student. It's a slowly evolving, decaying thing, unfortunately, where they lose a little bit of interest and they get a little bit behind. And because they're a little bit behind, they can't engage as much the next few days. And then the gap gets a little wider. And all of a sudden, 3 weeks later, they're like, I got to work so hard to catch up. It's not even worth it to me. And I never liked the subject anyway. I'm never going to be an architect. Why do I need to know math? You know, and they you know how kids are, teenagers are. They take everything to the nth degree very quickly like that.
Yes.
Well, you may not even have a teenager, but you will know this, believe me.
I know.
But I'm just saying, you know, this is just how it works. And so the answer is, I think parents got to stay on top of it if they're concerned at all. And even if they're not, they should make it their business to be. Not hours a day, but you know, check in, you know, what's going on here? What are you learning? And just insist on more than a one word answer. I think also early intervention is big. And this is where you do want to be in touch with the teacher. Now, when a teacher's in school, they should see this because they'll see the kid drifting off. But this is why I worry about it remotely, because I don't think it's harder to identify when these things are happening. So by the time it gets identified, the whole is deeper and wider. Mm-hmm. I'm not talking about kids with learning disabilities or, you know, spectrum based stuff. I'm just talking about a disinterested, bored student who'd rather be, you know, doing anything else than staring at a computer learning class.
It'll be really interesting to see what happens next year, assuming we're going back in person next year.
Yeah, which I think
in September. But it'll be really interesting to see what happens next year as far as like it'll be a year like no other because of this whole break in the middle. But yeah, I hear what you're saying. Like we need to, if you're worried about your kid, like you got to kind of stay on top of them. And I was in that situation, like with my youngest daughter, and she didn't want to, she wanted to do her work on a laptop in the corner of the corner couch. So nobody could see what was happening. Right. So mm-hmm. then she would kind of drift off and be looking at like fish tank stuff on Pinterest. And you know, she'd be doing her own research on like fish stuff, but she wasn't really engaged. And, you know, all these things happen. But yeah, there's a level of insistence of like, okay, well, if you're, you know, I got, then I guess I'll have to email your teacher and ask if you can't tell me what's going on or show me what's going on. We want to see the plan and all of that. And we can do that kindly. You know, like it's, it can be feel shameful and embarrassing for a kid to be not on top of things. Right. So we have to just remember that, take into account those feelings. We don't want to be adding layers of like shame and blame and hurt to a situation that may already be hurtful, but to that's our job, right. Is to kind of like say, okay, what is going on for you? Like be interested, be curious and
I think the theme here is not that you want to foster any contentious relationship with your child, but I think the spirit is that in this circumstance, I think the likelihood of a child who would maybe or maybe not become out of it in school, whatever that means, is greater to happen and to happen more quickly. Mm-hmm. Therefore, you'd want to put the brakes on it as soon as you can.
It's interesting because like kind of the advice we're saying is like if you have a kindergarten, first grader, even second grader, like let's lighten up and let's like have it be more play-based, more interest-based, things like that. But then we're saying on the other side of that, let's not fall behind.
Well, but you're talking, the difference between a 10th or 11th grader and a first grader academically is two completely different conversations. But because I think we're working on the assumption that by the time a kid's in 10th or 11th grade, they ought to be at least able to work independently.
Yeah.
They may not be given the opportunity to constantly, but they should be able to. So, and I think that's just goes along with teaching in high school. I mean, that's, and being a high school student. So,
ages we're kind of looking at like kind of being more concerned and more involved. What would you say they are as we start to kind of look at this? You know, we're letting ourselves chill and relax, the parents of the younger kids and make things more fun and interesting, right? Because we want to keep that spark of learning. At what ages are we starting to say, okay, let's get more involved, get more concerned?
I think you'd want to start to keep an eye on it in middle school, but without a really tight window. Because there's still time, right? Because look, for a lot of kids, I don't know what percent, but the vast majority of high school kids going into high school are, their basic goal is to get out of high school and go to college. Okay. For the most part, that's basically what our system has grown into. There's obviously other options, but so by the time they're in 10th or 11th grade, especially the end of 11th grade, a lot of that story has been written. They've got their grades. That's going to be their transcript. They're going to start doing applications in any year. This year's wacky, but it's still what it is. So if you drop the ball on your grades in 9th, 10th, 11th grade, has a much bigger impact on your life than it would have any other grades up until that point. 9th grade is always a little bit of a slippery slope because it's a transition year. Typically, you're moving from middle school building to a high school building. You're now the youngest kids in the building. They're the oldest ones in the old building. There are a few 7, 8, 9 high schools or junior highs. But so there's a socialization that happens in 9th grade that I think sometimes you have to give a little bit to. But certainly by late 9th grade and certainly into 10th grade, I think this is where the potential downside of poor performance really can put a kid back. And of course, in the moment, kids aren't thinking long-term. Kids not sitting there in the middle of 10th grade and go, oh, if I get a D on this test, it's, you know, I'm not going to get into Penn or whatever. But frankly, it's the pattern of that thought process that's going to get them into the wrong, you know, way things are going to work out. And by the time it's done, a year and a half later, it's too late. And I'm definitely not sitting here saying every parent should be on top of their kid every single day, making sure that they're incredibly perfect students. I'm just saying that because the monitoring that normally would happen in a classroom isn't really happening remotely, it's sort of by default incumbent on somebody else to do it. I think most parents are saying, well, my kid's old enough. They get it. They're this, they're that. I don't need to babysit a 16, 17 year old. That's probably should be true. But there is a fraction of that population that really isn't capable of working as independently. And comparatively speaking, I think they're the ones that are taking a little bit of a bigger hit in terms of academic performance and maybe opportunities down the road. And I think that's where the parents want to be aware of what's going on.
Okay. So that's where we want to step in. We want to be a helper. We want to be a support. Yes. We don't want to be
a heavy hand
here. We don't want to fight. We want to be a helper. We want to be support. We want to support them.
The fancy word would be an advocate.
An advocate. Yes.
Yeah. Advocate. How about that? Fancy word. But that's really what you want. The parents should be advocating for their child's success. The kids don't always appreciate that you're advocating for their success, but that's really what you're doing. And part of that is, you know, there's a tough love aspect to it, right? And there's a practical piece to it. And there's a piece to it where you're trying to foster a teenager becoming an adult behaviorally and responsibility wise. And that's part of what school is. You know, essentially a 16, 17 year old, that's their job. Some kids have jobs, but their main goal is to do as well as they can in school.
Yeah.
Parents' job is to give them the environment to do it.
Yeah. Which is another episode. We talked about that last fall, dear
yes.
listener.
Yeah, we got it. That's, the structure piece is a big, big piece right now. We didn't get into that at all. And I could talk about that for about 2 hours, but we won't today.
The structure piece. Well, we did do an episode on that with Kimberlyn Lavelle, and that was in the fall. I don't have the episode number off the top of my head, dear listener. I'm sorry, but go ahead and check back into that as far as structuring your home for remote learning and doing better mm-hmm. with that. Stephen, this has been really helpful, I think, a way of just kind of thinking, stepping back from this remote learning thing and kind of just thinking about it a little bit more clearly and objectively has certainly been helpful for me. I really appreciate what you're offering here. If people want to learn more about what you're doing and making the grade, and where can they find you?
Easiest thing is probably just to go to the website, which is makethegrade.net, makethegrade.net. There's all sorts of stuff on there, and there's a contact form where they can get a hold of me. My email is sgreene@makethegrade.net. I'm not the world's greatest social media diva, but I am on all of them somewhere, most of them at Make the Grade or at me. But typically it starts with an email. I have a lot of people reaching out with the biggest thing I see are people asking me if what they perceive to be a small problem is something they should really worry about becoming a larger problem. That's I'm getting a lot of that. You know, mm-hmm. my kid's doing this, should I be worried? Mm-hmm. And I'm not a psychologist, you know, I'm not a behavioral expert. I look at this as an academic. But I do know it's much easier to solve small problems than big ones. And that's, I think, where preparation and sticking with systems and understanding where you're at compared to you want to be goal setting is really important.
Okay. And any final words for the parents who are muddling through this as imperfectly as we are?
I mean, you could take so many views on that, but I think I'm going to go with this. I think I'd try to look at everything as an opportunity. Okay. So I think this is an opportunity to get out of the box a little bit, learn some new skills, maybe build relationships with your kids that you might not have otherwise, especially if you're working at home and essentially being a hall monitor, whatever, a principal to your child. And I think you just have to accept that this is what it is. You know, there's no point screaming and yelling about it and complaining and why isn't this and why isn't that? And, it's out of our control to a degree. So I would like to say, try to think of this as a learning experience and like for ourselves as well. And use that to build strength in other skills that maybe you didn't have or didn't think about getting in the past. So
thank you.
I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Thank you so much, Stephen. I really appreciate you coming on.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope that you got something out of this episode and it was helpful. If it was, of course, please share it with friends. Take a screenshot of you listening to it. Let me know what your takeaways were, what you're going to do differently, what you're not going to do. Maybe you're not going to worry so much about your younger kids. I hope so. And we have a lot of great episodes coming up for you. I mean, amazing conversations. And next week, we are going to be talking about how to communicate more skillfully with your kids. Another great one. And something super cool, by the way, this episode is the first episode that we are going to be releasing the video of on my YouTube channel at mindfulmamamentor.com. We'll put it under the podcast link and we will put that YouTube channel in there under this episode. And there's also a bunch of great resources there. So I have a book tab where you can get all special bonuses for when you buy Raising Good Humans in, you know, paperback or in hardcover, I think is coming out, and or an audiobook. You can learn more about joining the Mindful Parenting membership. And I also have a bunch of other resources on there. I have some free meditations. I have a Mindfulness for Moms guide. So you can learn more about that. And you can even learn more about the teacher certification program that I'm doing. I even have some yoga practices from way back when. You can practice 18 minutes of flow yoga with me in my spring garden. So check it out. That's all at mindfulmamamentor.com. Finally, I just want to say thank you. I feel really grateful for this connection that we have through talking. You dear listener, I feel really honored that you are sharing your time with me and spending your time with me. You know, I want to live up to that all the time. I always think about the quality of this podcast and I want to show up really honestly very authentically for you and to be real for you and to provide you resources that you find valuable and to just, you know, open up this conversation, to add to this conversation, to add to this revolution. So I'm really grateful for you and your time, and I'm really honored that you share it with me. So thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. And I wish you a beautiful, peaceful week with some joys and some rest and all the good things. See you next week. Namaste.
I'd say definitely do it. It's really helpful. It will change your relationship with your kids for the better. It will help you communicate better. And just, I'd say communicate better as a person, as a wife, as a spouse. It's been really a positive influence in our lives. So definitely do it.
I'd say definitely do it. It's so worth it. The money really is inconsequential when you get so much benefit from being a better parent to your children and feeling like you're connecting more with them and not feeling like you're yelling all the time or you're like, why isn't things working? I would say definitely do it. It's so, so worth it. It'll change you.
No matter what age someone's child is, it's a great opportunity for personal growth and it's a great investment in someone's family. I'm very thankful I had this.
You can continue in your old habits that aren't working, or you can learn some new tools and gain some perspective to shift everything in your parenting.
Are you frustrated by parenting? Do you listen to the experts and try all the tips and strategies, but you're just not seeing the results that you want? Or are you lost as to where to start? Does it all seem so overwhelming with too much to learn? Are you yearning for a community of people who get it, who also don't want to threaten and punish to create cooperation? Hi, I'm Hunter Clark Fields, and if you answered yes to any of these questions, I want you to seriously consider the Mindful Parenting membership. You'll be joining hundreds of members who have discovered the path of mindful parenting and now have confidence and clarity in their parenting. This isn't just another parenting class. This is an opportunity to really discover your unique, lasting relationship, not only with your children, but with yourself. It will translate into lasting, connected relationships, not only with your children, but your partner too. Let me change your life. Go to mindfulparentingcourse.com to add your name to the waitlist so you will be the first to be notified when I open the membership for enrollment. I look forward to seeing you on the inside. mindfulparentingcourse.com.
I'm Margaret.
And I'm Amy.
And together we host the podcast, What Fresh Hell? Laughing in the Face of Motherhood.
Margaret, I would say you're sort of a where are my keys kind of mom.
Correct. Sometimes a where are my kids kind of mom. Well, you're, Amy, more of a we were supposed to leave 35 seconds ago, mom.
I mean, touche. In each episode of What Fresh Hell, we come at a topic from our usually completely opposite perspectives. I bring the research.
And I bring kind of the gimlet eye. Like, is that research really going to work, people?
And almost 10 million downloads later, we're still laughing.
We also talk to experts in the parenting field, plus parents with stories we can all learn from.
We make each other laugh, we challenge each other's assumptions, and we have what we think is the best parenting community on the internet.
Check out What Fresh Hell, Laughing in the Face of Motherhood, wherever you listen to podcasts.